Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit MemoriaPressAcademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Christ's birth, like this tree, is a reminder that God is always with us. We may neglect him, we may reject him, but he never forsakes us.
The New York-based and Washington-based, too, probably media powerhouses, don't quite get religion. We don't get the role of religion in people's lives.
The colors of the rainbow went from blue on one edge of the rainbow to red on the other. And they saw in that a reminder that just as God once destroyed the world with water, he will again destroy the world, this time by fire.
Uber drivers around the world love listening to Issues Etc. on demand while we're waiting for a ride request.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. When scientists get together, they generally tend to report their findings with one another. It's always kind of a state of the science meeting. They're gathering information, they're talking to one another, they're having discussions. They don't always agree with one another. Now, in science, a good theory, I'm not a scientist, but at least I've given to believe that a good theory in science ought to at least be able to do two things. It ought to be able to explain a thing, whatever the theory pertains to, and it ought to be able to, in addition to that, make certain predictions about the thing that can be tested, that can be verified, that can be replicated, so that we know whether or not a theory is sound and solid and really explains what it purports to explain. What about neo-Darwinian evolution, or just evolution for short? What was admitted at a recent conference in London about evolutionary theory? We're going to be talking about that with Doug Axe. He's a molecular biologist. A little bit later, we'll spend some time with Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard, discussing with him two issues he's written on recently. One, the Democratic excuses for Trump's victory and presidential vote recounts. Our call-in number over the next hour, 1-877-623-6943, 877-623-MYIE. Send us an email, talkback@issuesetc.org, tweet at issuesetc, or use the Issues Etc. comment line whenever, wherever you listen, 618-223-8382. Joining us to talk about a recent conference in London on trends in evolutionary biology, Doug Axe. He's a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute for the Discovery Institute, and author of the new book, Undeniable: How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. He attended the Royal Society meeting last month in London. Doug, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hey, it's good to be here.
In terms of scientific meetings, of what caliber is the Royal Society? How big a deal is this meeting?
It's a big, big deal. The Royal Society is the top scientific organization in the UK. And of course, even though the U.S. is much bigger than the U.K., we came from the U.K., and science has just rich, the Western tradition of science is richly developed in the U.K., and so this is considered to be perhaps the most esteemed organization in science.
What ordinarily happens at these meetings?
I've only been to a couple of Royal Society meetings. They tend to be highly regarded speakers who come and give presentations, and most of the people who are participating are not speakers. They're simply attending and listening and taking notes, and there's Q&A time after each talk. This one was a little different in that everyone could tell from the way it was presented, the way it was pitched on the web, maybe 6 months or 9 months before the actual meeting, that there was going to be some controversy dealt with.
So there was a term used here by one of the presenters at the Royal Society regarding what he called explanatory deficits in neo-Darwinian evolutionary theory. What was he talking about?
I probably heard that. I don't remember which speaker that was, but a good number of them. There were about two dozen speakers. a good number of them were talking about something like that, things that natural selection and random mutation don't explain. So there are all kinds of subjects that were discussed, all of them revolving around the idea that biology in the last several decades has shown that there are mechanisms of inheritance that aren't genetic, or there are mechanisms that govern what the next generation look like that don't have anything to do with natural selection. So things are outside the Darwinian box. The interesting thing at this meeting is there were also two or three presenters who were very orthodox, old-school Darwinists who tried to defend the fact that, no, none of these things actually have displaced Darwin's theory from the center stage. It still is the main evolutionary theory, and while these ideas are not false, they haven't actually replaced random mutation and natural selection. So that was the gist of the tension.
So does it, as you observe that, some of these admissions about kind of the shortcomings of neo-Darwinian evolution, does, and then the conflict with the old school scientists, does it represent at least kind of a split in the ranks of evolutionists at this point?
Yes, it certainly does. And if you read the technical literature, which most people don't, you'll see this all the time in evolutionary journals, that there's heated debate about is natural selection the powerful thing that Darwin thought it was? And I would say a growing majority say it's not. But most of these people are still evolutionists, in that they believe that life came about through a natural process. They're just quibbling about what the key to that process is.
I'm trying to think of it in layperson's terms. Are the problems
Sure.
that the current theory can't explain things like how structures in living creatures develop when the living creature had no need for the structure prior to that in its evolutionary chain or its alleged evolutionary chain?
No, okay, so that was the even more interesting part of the meeting, is there were probably two dozen people there, including me, who just don't think that we don't believe that there can be a naturalistic explanation for life. So the sort of thing that was the upfront tension in this meeting was between the old school and the new school evolutionary biologists who are arguing about the role of natural selection, basically. Is that the main thing that drives evolution or not? And a good number of us were sitting in the audience thinking, I don't believe any of this drives the origin or the invention of new things. So I refer to that in something I wrote as being the elephant in the room. None of these people, despite the fact they're arguing back and forth over who should get, you know, the most pages in the biology textbooks, they're not explaining ultimately where life comes from or where new things come from. That requires intelligence. And there were a few moments where that issue was raised, and it brought a heated response. People don't want to go that way.
I guess that raises the question, how are you and other intelligent design advocates, how are you received or regarded at meetings like the Royal Society?
Well, we were there in good number, and we had conversations at lunchtime and at break time. And I think this is like so many other meetings that I've been to, that on record, nobody wants to give us the time of day. Often through relationships, you can find that there are good conversations, and there are things that are conceded at lunchtime or during the break when there's no microphone there that are not at all conceded up front. So it's kind of there's sort of a two-faced element to this. Everyone's afraid of associating with the intelligent design camp because they don't want to be punished for breaking ranks with the Darwinian camp or with being seen to encourage the sort of radical revision of an understanding of life that we represent. But quietly, they have their misgivings and they will have conversations. If you can make a friendship with these people, they will quietly admit that they see problems with the theory. So they're stuck.
So what does that tell you about the future of the theory? While you've noted there that there are kind of old school Darwinists who, despite the explanatory deficit, so to speak, are just going to stick by the theory. What does it tell you when you find scientists who will publicly still advocate for the theory, but will privately either admit their doubts or admit greater doubts than they would publicly?
Well, it tells me, the first thing it tells me is that science is a very social phenomenon. It's a very human phenomenon. All the things that get in the way of progress in any other human sphere, they get in the way of progress in the sciences. It's about politics and egos when it gets down to it. It's about, you know, peer pressure and fear and all those things that we knew from early childhood in the schoolyard, they're present in the way science is actually practiced. The hope that it gives me is there really are a large number of people out there who have serious doubts about whether evolutionary theory works. Most of them are afraid to say that. I'm talking about people that are in academic positions. But the more young people get into these academic positions who actually favor design position or are severe critics of evolutionary theory, the more likely it is that at some point in the next generation there will be a tipping point when people can come out and say what they really think and not be afraid to do that.
Are you aware of any scientists in the evolutionary camp? I mean, people who are currently, at least publicly, devoted to the theory, who are looking for an alternative because they're concerned that the theory may not be able to hold the water everyone thought it was able to do for so long?
A good number. I would say 3/4 or more of the people that were at this Royal Society meeting are in that camp. So like Jim Shapiro at University of Chicago has, for a long time, broken ranks with the classic neo-Darwinist camp. He doesn't think that explains how new things appear, but he has his other explanation that comes within naturalism, so he's not favoring intelligent design. He thinks there's a genetic toolkit that allows evolution to do things that would never happen just by simple mutation and selection, that cells and life forms are more clever than that. They have sort of built-in mechanisms that they can do clever things. At the end of the day, I don't think his solution is any more viable than the classic Darwinian solution, because apart from insight and intelligence, none of these cellular mechanisms can invent new things. And I've had that dialogue with Jim Shapiro. He doesn't want to come the intelligent design way. So it's an interesting dynamic.
What is, before we take this break, what is keeping them back from saying, look, I don't know what it's going to look like in the future, but design seems to be the best explanatory model for what we see in the chain of life? What's holding them back?
I would say culture. It comes down to peer pressure. A lot of people might think that, but they're afraid to say it because they're afraid of what will happen to them, lose their grant funding, lose their, you know, position, lose their promotion, and lose their ability to publish. So it's peer pressure that's keeping people. Now, not everyone is agreeing with the idea that the evolutionary paradigm has failed, but there's a large number who see that.
Doug Ax is our guest. We're talking about a recent conference in London on new trends in evolutionary biology. He's a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute for the Discovery Institute, author of the new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed, and he attended the Royal Society meeting last month in London. More with him after this.
We're destined to be Darwin's children this time.
I bet you didn't know that the teaching of Latin in schools is making a comeback. Latin? Really? Isn't that a dead language? Well, take a look at what studies say about how well Latin students do on a test like the SAT. Memoria Press's Latin program will revolutionize your students' vocabulary, knowledge, and their understanding of grammar. And there is no better subject for teaching critical thinking skills. Visit memoriapress.com and save $5 on your next order by using the coupon code LPR.
Please help us finish in the black financially for the 9th consecutive year by making a year-end tax-deductible gift. With 3 weeks left, we're $54,000 short of expenses. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org. You can also contribute by check. Make your check payable to Issues Etc. and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois 62234. Thanks for listening, and thanks for thinking of Issues Etc. at the end of 2016.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
I'm not a Christian, but I listen to your show because actually you do have some interesting topics.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues, Etc. comment line.
Do you believe that there's not one error in the Bible? That's intellectually infantile. You also believe that Jesus is coming again. You promote extremely sexually repressive views.
The Issues, Etc. comment line. Available 24/7. 618-223-8382.
Have fun waiting for Jesus to return. Got news for you. He ain't coming back.
LCMS Disaster Response provides guidance and assistance to congregations who seek to proclaim the gospel and show mercy in the wake of disasters. We can bring capacity to your congregation through on-site assessment, volunteer training and congregation preparedness, and through grants direct to your congregation. For more information, follow us on Facebook, keyword LCMS Disaster Response, or visit our website at lcms.org/disaster. That's lcms.org/disaster.
Dust in the wind. All we are is dust in the wind.
All we are is dust in the wind.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a recent conference in London on new trends in evolutionary biology. Doug Axe of the Discovery Institute is our guest. Before the break, we were talking about what's holding evolutionists back now, the scientists who are devoted to evolution, back from simply looking for another way or pursuing some of the things suggested by intelligent design. Do they already, in a sense, perhaps even unwittingly, tip their hand toward design? When in their language, and I've noticed this again and again, in their language about evolutionary processes, they will speak in design terms. They will speak as though there were an intelligence at work in the mechanisms.
I think that's very true. It's probably more true in other areas of biology. If you just grab a biology textbook and it's talking about the role of various proteins within the cell and what enzymes do and why they do it and why they do it this way, not that way. It's almost impossible to talk about life without talking about purpose and intent and design. I think evolutionary biologists are maybe more well-trained to be careful about how they use those words because they're so worried about being misinterpreted, and intelligent design has become so such a hot controversy that I think they become allergic to design language. They try to be very careful not to use it. Interestingly, at the Royal Society meeting, there was one person who gave a talk on just that, the use of teleological, even anthropomorphic language, speaking about things as though they have purpose. And he specifically said, I'm not advocating design. I'm just saying that this kind of language works in biology, and so we shouldn't be afraid to use it. But that was a very controversial talk, and people got quite emotional afterward, accusing him of opening the door to real design thinking.
Can neo-Darwinian evolution, can it explain something as basic as, say, the Cambrian explosion, this dramatic appearance in the fossil record of life forms, where before it seems almost absent?
I would say unequivocally no. It can't even explain things that are far simpler than that. My own work has looked at single protein molecules and whether the neo-Darwinian mechanism can invent new proteins, either completely new three-dimensional shapes that do new functions, or even taking an existing shape and retasking it for a new function. And we found experimentally and adding the math of how selection works that it doesn't do either of those tasks well. It totally fails on the invention of new protein structures. And in a very, very apparently favorable case of retasking an existing structure, retooling it for a new function, we find that it even failed there.
If evolution doesn't have the explanatory force for that, and can't demonstrate that that actually occurs at the molecular level within a cell,
right,
then it's pretty much doomed, isn't it? Because that is supposed to be where it happens.
Yeah, I would say it's game over. That's why that's the problem that I was most interested in tackling as a graduate student. I thought the single gene, single functional molecule level is the level where you can get direct answers. You can do the experiments, you can do the calculation, and find out whether it works or not. If it doesn't work there, then it certainly doesn't work at the level of inventing new tissues or new organs or new organisms.
So it can't even get out of the starting gate. What does the what does the dedicated evolutionist say about results like that?
Well, it's interesting. We've been all along, I've been doing this for 25 years or so with colleagues, and we've been publishing our work. We anticipate the sorts of responses we get, and we try to anticipate them when we write papers, the sorts of objections or sorts of complaints that people will have. Interestingly, when we've done what we call these A to B transitions, so we've taken existing structure and see whether it can evolve a new function without radical change in the shape, it just has to change the active site part where it actually does the chemistry. We find that that doesn't work. And the complaint has been that modern enzymes are so well perfected by natural selection that they no longer evolve. So in other words, we go into the lab and show that enzymes don't evolve, and the response of the evolutionary community could be, okay, that means there's a problem. We need to go back to the drawing board. Maybe the theory is wrong. Instead, they say, no, natural selection has so perfected the modern forms that you shouldn't have expected them to be able to evolve. They're no longer evolvable. So the theory has become a set of ideas about things that no longer exist. And because they don't exist, you can't go into the laboratory and test them. It's really become almost ludicrous. I think it's a last-ditch effort to avoid conceding defeat. And it's been the same line is given for organismal evolution, the change of actual organisms, the origin of species. The same sort of arguments are given that modern life forms are resistant to change and we shouldn't expect them to be able to evolve. They've already been perfected by selection. They've reached an endpoint and they're no longer malleable. They can't be transformed anymore. It becomes a theory about that which does not exist. And if you go into the lab and try to reproduce some prior, earlier form and show that it doesn't evolve, then they'll say you obviously didn't do it right because the earlier forms did evolve and what you tested doesn't.
I mean, isn't that the same as me saying I saw Elvis alive on the corner of West and Main? And when you go to West and Main and you don't find Elvis, they say, well, he was here, but he isn't here and he'll never be here again because he's moved to China or something like that.
It takes it totally out of the realm of the testable and the observable. It doesn't really even qualify as a scientific theory anymore.
Now, is that, you said that's a novel tactic. Is that something that neo-Darwinism has even suggested, that evolution has a perfection point where, and it's pretty convenient that we happen to be testing it right now at the perfection point, that organisms will no longer evolve? Doesn't that itself require kind of rewriting the theory about this blind force that continues to improve organisms?
It's totally contrary to what Charles Darwin himself wrote in The Origin of Species. He thought that evolution was continually, constantly scrutinizing life in its various forms and rejecting everything that's bad, preserving all that's good. So he viewed evolution as something that's constant and continual. As the conditions of life change, so life changes with them. So this is a radical departure from that. This is now the idea that natural selection can lock things in so they become committed to being what they are and they no longer respond to changes in conditions. Natural selection no longer reshapes them because they've been locked into their existing shape. And it's that same idea that's being applied at the level of whole body plans and organisms all the way down to individual protein molecules and genes.
Well, I said it's convenient because not only can you make that claim now without having to prove it, because there's no way of proving it. If you say, well, evolution just isn't happening anymore, it's turned off. But you also can't go back in time, and neither you nor the evolutionists can go back in time to prove or disprove that it was happening before.
Correct. I think what we need to emphasize in this case is we're all agreeing then that evolution does not work. And if they can say, okay, we agree on that, that's a huge concession. Now, they're claiming, but it did. And we're saying, but the fact is, it doesn't. And we all agree on that, right? And we're coming close to the point where that's really being implicitly conceded.
Has that particular tactic found its way into the popular literature? And I'm thinking here in particular about textbooks, biology textbooks and the like.
No, I don't think it has. Because it's so clearly a dodge, and it's an evasion of reality, of scientific reality, and I think people would see through it. We're seeing this in, for example, someone who critiqued the book by Stephen Meyer, Darwin's Doubt, that spoke about the Cambrian explosion that you referred to earlier. His critique, this is Charles Marshall, his critique was, we shouldn't expect these things to evolve anymore, because when we do experiments on fruit flies in the lab, they're locked in to being fruit flies. They're not going to be these genes that did their magic before won't do their magic anymore. It's that very argument. But that's not in, you won't find that if you're taking AP biology and, you know, using Campbell's biology text. You'll find that only if you dig around a little bit in the technical literature.
Will any of those you talked about, the scientific colleagues who are still devoted to evolution publicly, but will privately say, I'm having my doubts, will any of them, for lack of a better word, kind of call BS on that tactic?
I hope so. This is a situation like so many others in human history where it takes some backbone and some gut, some willingness to take a risk to stand up for what's clearly right. And not everyone will do that because they can push up to the edge. We've been at meetings where people who are quite prominent evolutionists have conceded that our work is solid, and then they realized that this was actually recorded. There was an audio recording, and they went berserk right after the meeting, realizing that their words could be played back. We never did play them back, but that's the sort of world we live in. That's the sort of culture that's dominating in the sciences.
I guess I asked before whether there were people looking for an alternative in the evolutionary community. Is there, to your knowledge, anyone who's kind of waiting in the wings, besides intelligent design theorists, who are saying, look, Darwin was great for his time, but we got to move on from Darwin. It's the theory's too flawed. Here's a new idea, a naturalistic idea. Is there anybody waiting there with the grand theory, not just a theory about certain aspects of the evolution of life?
I wouldn't call it grand theory. There's something that's called the third way, and they're thinking exactly along those terms, that the first way is Darwin's way, or maybe creationism is the first way, Darwin's way is the second way, and they're looking at a third way that is naturalistic, doesn't require God to have acted, but gets out of all the problems that have beset Darwin's theory. But it really is kind of a hodgepodge of people like the ones who were at the Royal Society. In fact, some of the prominent people who are identified with the third way were speakers at the Royal Society meeting. It isn't really a coherent, grand theory. It still does not explain the origin of new things. It doesn't explain invention of remarkable things. And until you can do that, you haven't explained life. Now, I argue in my book, Undeniable, that no naturalistic theory will ever do that. And I argue that it's really a matter of common sense why it will always fail. You always need insight to do invention. It's never going to happen by accident.
So finally, in a nutshell, for the layperson, why is Darwinian evolution bad science?
Well, I think in terms of how it's being practiced, I don't think Darwin's hypothesis is bad. It's perfectly healthy for hypotheses to put forward that turn out to be completely false if they're honestly tested and everyone's being honest about what the data says. What I think makes evolutionary theory bad science today is we're not allowing an honest testing of it. The testing is happening, and the people who are saying it doesn't work are being excluded from the dialogue. So I don't think there's anything wrong with proposing a theory or even proposing that there might be a way that life can be explained by accident. But to do science well, with integrity, you have to be willing for that to be refuted, and it is being refuted, and the academy, the scientific establishment, is refusing to accept that.
Doug Axe is a molecular biologist, director of the Biologic Institute for the Discovery Institute, author of the new book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life is Designed. He attended the Royal Society meeting last month in London. You'll find a link to the book, Undeniable, How Biology Confirms Our Intuition That Life Is Designed, at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. A link also to the Discovery Institute. Doug, thank you very much for being our guest.
Thank you for having me.
Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard is going to join us in a few minutes. We're going to be talking with him about two issues: Democratic excuses for Trump's victory. He has a list of, I think he called them, three dumb arguments about Donald Trump's victory. And we'll walk through them one by one. We'll also talk about the ongoing presidential vote recounts. Mark Hemingway of the Weekly Standard is with us on this Wednesday, December the 14th, right after this. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc.
Come listen to Drs. Alvin Schmidt and Roland Elke at the 3rd Annual Concordia Apologetics Conference, Cultures in Collision, Faith and a Fractured World, this March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin. You can register online at www.cuw.edu/apologetics or call 262-243-4343. That's the Concordia Apologetics Conference, March 3rd and 4th at Concordia University, Wisconsin.
Do you have a student finishing up 8th grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Advent season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Advent season, LutheranPublicRadio.org.
It was the day after Christmas in 1538 when family and friends who were gathered around Luther's table heard him say, "There is no finer gift that a parent can give to a child than an education in the liberal arts." For over 100 years, St. Paul's Lutheran School in Brookfield, Illinois, has been emphasizing the six chief parts and the seven liberal arts, providing classical education in the Lutheran tradition. Visit our website at spbrookfield.org or call 708-485-0650.
We love our on-demand listeners. You're listening to Issues Etc.
It is the greatest adventure you could ever possibly imagine. It's demanding, it's hard, it's challenging, and what a blessing it is.
Dr. Larry Rast, president of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on why a man should consider the vocation of pastor.
And it is an incredible blessing to be honored with the opportunity to work with these incredible young men and older men as well, who are committing themselves to the proclamation of God's word, the right distinction of law and gospel, and to take the good news of Jesus Christ into all the world.
You can find out more about studying for the pastoral ministry at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at ctsfw.edu or call 1-800-481-2155. Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, forming servants in Jesus Christ who teach the faithful, reach the lost, and care for all.